Vacuum on at 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. Vacuum on at 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
From out of nowhere, the Flying Saucer Mystery is with us. What is the Flying Saucer? What do people see and sometimes photograph? What's behind the daily reports of aerial phenomena in the nation's press? After more than 5 years of study, there is still no agreement, even among the experts.
Okay. This is one of the most fascinating aspects of the entire UFO subject to me. I have been interested in the Wilbert Smith story for years. Grant Cameron, our next speaker, has been involved with the UFO subject since 1975. He's followed the Smith case for 25 years. He's amassed a great amount of information, a lot of it previously unknown about Wilbert Smith. And he's also been involved with the MJ-12 business. He and T. Scott Crane did a book called UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government, I believe is the title, which MUFON still has for sale. If you want to get a copy of that, well worth your time. I think from what you've heard about Wilbert Smith in the past, some of you have undoubtedly read about him. He was the Canadian scientist who apparently had access to very high levels of the U.S. government. He was the one who was responsible for the quotation that UFOs are the most highly classified subject in the U.S. government. And he also used, I guess we would say, very unconventional methods sometimes in obtaining information from the extraterrestrials themselves. Please welcome our first Canadian speaker in the last 14 years, Grant Cameron.
First of all, I'd like to thank Lou for inviting me to come and tell some stories. America's quite the country. They actually fly people around just to tell stories. And I do mean stories because, as far as I'm concerned, until the President of the United States stands up and says extraterrestrials are what this is all about, we're basically just telling each other stories. Because I refer to the maestro, the person who is running this whole orchestra of cover-up. They control the bodies, they control the hardware, they control the documents, and all the rest is just basically stories. I'd also like to thank Lou for his gracious and kind introduction. He made a valiant attempt to try to make me sound like I might know what I'm talking about, so I'll try not to embarrass him too badly. The first thing I'd like to say to you as an audience is that I hope you realize the heavy hitters that Lou has brought in here this weekend to speak. I go to a lot of UFO conventions, and usually I know, say, between 30 and 50% of the speakers that are there. And the other 50%, I usually say, well, who's this guy? Like, what's he talking about? And all the people that have spoken here or that are on the list, I know all of them. And the vast majority of them I've actually hit up for information. I phone them up, can you tell me a UFO story? I've dealt with all these people over the years, and I'm quite impressed with the lineup of speakers that have been brought in here. As Lou said, I was brought in here to talk about Wilbert Smith. There's an interview that we're going to play here, and it was done with Wilbur Smith's son a month ago, and I guess Lou heard the interview and was talking to some Canadian people, and I was suggested as the person who probably knows more Wilbur Smith stories than anyone. When I agreed, I looked at the list of speakers, and I sort of feel a little bit like I'm in the seventh game of a World Series, and it's the bottom of the ninth inning, and there's two out, and there's bases loaded, and we're one run down, and I'm the pitcher coming up to hit. And the manager's saying, I think we're going to win this thing, like, what's going on? You know, like, we've got this thing in the bag, and who's next up to hit? And they say, oh, no, not the pitcher. So I feel a little intimidated by some of these people that I've looked to for many years for information. As Lou also said, I'm from Canada, eh? And I'm considered a bit of a traitor in my own country, as I'm quite often in the States. In fact, this year I may actually be in the States every month. And I'm just, despite the number of places I've been and the number of states I've been in doing research, this is the first time I've ever been to Arkansas, and I'd like to say I'm very happy to be here. And it's an honor to be in the state that actually created the rooster president. When Clinton was in office, I hated the guy. And to me, it was like a boxing fight between him and Ken Starr. And I can tell you honestly, I was pulling for Ken Starr. Come on, Ken, like, hit him, come on. You know, like, knock him, his knees are wobbling. Come on, knock him out. And basically, when all was said and done, Bill Clinton remained standing through the entire fight. And about a month before Bill and President Hillary left office, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Clinton administration, and more specifically with the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is the office of Clinton's science advisor, Dr. Jack Gibbons. When all was said and done, I managed to collect over 1,000 pages of UFO documents from the Clinton White House. And this is only one agency inside the White House that was exempt that you could file a Freedom of Information Act request. The Clinton Library opens in 2006, January. Freedom of Information requests are available for all the Clinton departments, and I can guarantee you, if I'm not the first in line with my stack of Freedom of Information Act requests at that library, I'm going to be pretty close to the front of the line when it opens. Because the Clinton, what these documents that I got showed was that they weren't just ordinary documents. Usually when you get government documents, you get citing reports, letters from people in the public and stuff. What these documents were, they were letters signed by people like Lawrence Rockefeller, former Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, Dr. Billy Graham. And what the documents also showed that President Clinton had green-lighted the disclosure process. The Roswell report that some of you may know on that was done by the Air Force in 1994-95, whenever they put it out, was green-lighted by Clinton. The 1997 CIA report that was put out by the CIA was green-lighted by Clinton. Now, both those studies turned out to be whitewashes, but that's not really Clinton's fault. Clinton sort of got nothing because Clinton was from the South, like Jimmy Carter, and people from the South aren't respected in Washington. And the second reason that these things were whitewashed and Clinton didn't get anything is the fact that Clinton ran his campaign against the Washington insiders. He ran against Washington when he won, and you shouldn't be too surprised if you get to Washington and you're running against Washington when you get there that nobody cooperates with you. Now I feel very bad that I was wanting Kenny to beat him up, because now I actually sort of like Bill Clinton. And what it goes to show is an important lesson I think we have to learn in ufology, and that is that you shouldn't count the horses until they're all in the barn, which means I might yet change my opinion on George W. Bush, but I wouldn't hold my breath. Okay, can we go to the first slide? Okay, first slide. My topic is going to be Wilbur Smith, who was the head of the Canadian government flying saucer study. Hang on here. Gee. Just a sec, we got to go back here. This is technology here. First I had to learn to build a website, then I had to learn to use this thing. And hang on, we'll get it. going back. Go. Somehow it missed a slide here. Here it is. Okay, this is my website. You can write it down. My interest is basically the presidents, what the presidents know. And I have, being a Canadian, we don't put everything on the website all at one time, but I have quite a bit of material, and I'm not here to lecture on this, but basically what I'm going to say is for the Arkansas people, I have, I think, 6 or 7 major sections on the Clintons and UFOs, and I would encourage you to read it, because goodness knows nobody else does. I go to my website. I used to go every day to see who's on there, how many hits I've got, all that kind of stuff. And recently I only go once a week because it's very discouraging. I go there and I always push on the most popular page to see what people are reading, and it's almost always the picture page. And I think to myself, what is this, kindergarten? What people can't read, or what is the problem here? I work on this Clinton stuff and I think it's really good, and I've got on there and there's like 2 people a day reading it. So I would encourage you to get on this and read some of the Clinton material. And what I've started to do now, because people aren't really reading the articles, is I've started to... What am I... This thing's missing pages here. My worst nightmare here. It's missing a slide. I guess we'll have to miss it. I've started to put on presidential UFO cartoons. For some reason, it's not coming up here. Yeah, it was there, but now I can't. It's skipping over that page for whatever reason. Now, class notes. What I've done, and I should make a note here, the Wilbur Smith stuff, I'm not going to discuss his book, which he wrote. There was 4 printings of his book done, and it was called A New Science. And this was material that Smith wrote on how the universe works, the 12 dimensions, and he claimed that the majority of this stuff was given to him by the aliens. It's very complex stuff. It's not being printed anymore. This is one of the few copies that remains. Anybody who's interested in that kind of stuff, I have a copy that you can sort of page through it, as long as you don't steal it, and take a look at it. I'm not going to discuss, there's so many Wilbur Smith stories, I'm not going to discuss stuff like the binding meters, this sort of stuff. But what I will guarantee you, you're going to hear enough stories that, as we would say in Canada, it's better than a kick in the rear end with a frozen boot. You're going to hear some very bizarre stories. And because there were so many, what I have done is I have put a lot of stories on a website. I built a website for this lecture. The majority of the notes that I'm using for this lecture are on that website. A lot of stories that I'm just going to refer to, for example, one of Smith's people related to me a story about a crash of a U-2 in Canada and the unbelievable job that the Americans did to recover this thing. Stories like that, I'm going to refer to stories that are on the website that I really haven't got time to tell. Document lectures always fail. If you start getting into documents and you start dealing with documents, people just get sort of lost. I have a number of documents that I'm going to refer to, very important documents that surround the Wilbur Smith case and the Canadian study. All those documents are on this website. And the website is at the bottom of the page. You can write it down. And everything is on there. The other thing I have that has never been released is I have all the groups and the names of people around Wilbur Smith. Wilbur Smith had a whole series of people around him. He had, for example, what I'm going to refer to as the inner circle. This was 5 or 6 people very close to Wilbur Smith that were working on experiments with him. He had U.S. government officials that he was dealing with, I name them. Canadian government officials, I name them. Ottawa Flying Saucer Club, I refer to that. Project Magnet people, I name. Project Second Story people, I name. And all that stuff is on the website. The next piece is very important. I would encourage everybody to read it, because usually stuff that I write, I don't really respect too much. But the stuff that I put together on the Smith quotes is excellent. I mean, it is Wilbur Smith on crash flying saucers, Wilbur Smith on aliens, Wilbur Smith on communication with aliens, Wilbur Smith on hardware, Wilbur Smith on the government cover-up, Wilbur Smith on White House interns. Everything is there, everything you wanted to read. And I encourage you to read that. The final thing I have, because Wilbur Smith headed the Canadian government UFO program, or flying saucer program, he was asked on a number of occasions the ultimate question, so why is the government covering this up? Wilbur Smith wrote an article called Official Reticence. It's a long article, and that's his answer. You're reading a guy who ran the Canadian government UFO study, and he's telling you why the government is covering this thing up. The last two items, Smith's quotes and the official reticence, For people who don't have internet access, I have about 150 copies of a readout, like a handout, that are available at the front desk. So you can get them at the front desk, and they have the Smith quotes, and they have the article Official Reticence. But there's, because there's so many people here, I think there's 150 copies or something, I would ask that first the people who don't have internet access pick it up. And they're two very important things that I'm really not going to have time to get into. Now, let's see if this skips again. Okay, Wilbert Smith, as we said, was the director of Canada's official flying saucer program. And I say flying saucer for a very specific reason, that being that, except for a few occasions, Wilbur Smith never used the word UFO. Never. The odd time he'd use it. He always called them flying saucers. He always called them saucers. He always called them spaceship. He knew the reality of this phenomenon right from the word go, and we're going to tell you about that. And I think he also realized that the U.S. Air Force's development of the term UFO in 1952 was in part a counterintelligence move to muddy the waters, and it's worked extremely well. So that's why I refer to it as the official flying saucer study. Now, Smith as a case study. As far as I'm concerned, this is one of the most dramatic stories in ufology. It may not be the most important story in ufology, but it is in the top five. It is that if you see what actually was going on, and I'm only going to tell you part of the story, you'll see that it is one of the most important stories that has come down the pike. It's also a story that reveals what the government might know, because Wilbur Smith did talk about what was going on, and he was the guy. There was nobody working for, he wasn't working for really anybody. It's not like Project Blue Book, where Project Blue Book is sending their stuff to somebody else. This was the guy at the top. And the most important thing that I hope I'm going to get across today is a forced reassessment of the metaphysical aspects of ufology. And I am going to talk about this until you're absolutely sick about it. It's a very important part of the Smith thing. And what it basically comes down to is until we learn metaphysics and start applying it to the field of ufology, we are going nowhere. And that's maybe why we haven't gotten anywhere. Okay, how I got involved. I got involved in a flap of UFO sightings in 1975, 1976 in Carmen, Manitoba, which is, I live in Manitoba, which is just above the North Dakota border, about 60 miles. And I had no interest in UFOs, just went out one day, there was a bunch of sightings and it was in the newspaper, and we went out and we decided we wanted to go and see what everybody was looking at. Saw it, it absolutely changed my life. Bob Pratt, who spoke here last night, was actually up there covering the story. It was connected with a bunch of sightings that happened in Wisconsin, was going on at exactly the same time. Bob Pratt came up and the National Enquirer was going to do a story, UFO Capital of the World, and the story, I don't think even made the paper. I don't believe it was actually printed. But in 1975, there's big objects flying around. In 1976, we dealt with a series of small objects that we called ground lights. And when I talked to some of the Inner Circle people, one of them lived in my area, and he said, oh, you mean monitors? And I said, yeah, okay, monitors. And he said, well, we had those back in Ottawa all the time, Wilbert and I. And they started describing these stories about these little things that we were chasing, and I was 50 feet away from one. At one time, I was ready to jump on the thing. And the Smith people talked about, in fact, his wife told me the story, and on this interview that I'm going to refer to later on, Wilbur Smith's son talks about this. They were small little objects, 18 inches, 24 inches across, and the Ottawa Flying Saucer people, when they would have meetings, they described that these little objects would come, and basically they were monitoring the situation. They were following Wilbur Smith around. And these things would sit outside the window of the basement while they were having UFO meetings, and they said it would look like it was brilliant, lit up, like a donut. And I remember when I interviewed Mrs. Smith in the mid-70s, she told me that they would burn out a whole row of beans. It destroyed a tree in the backyard, and I think it was actually a neighbor's tree. Wilbur Smith's son talks about coming out and seeing one of these things beside the sidewalk, and it had killed the grass, this sort of stuff. And even Smith's neighbors knew about this. Wilbur Smith's neighbors said, Wilbur, we don't care where your little friends are from or what they're doing here, just keep them out of our yard. Now, the reason I got involved in this whole thing, I was working on these sightings, and I was taking tours out to see these little monitors and flashing lights at them, like Stephen Greer, and these things were responding and stuff. And I actually had one case where an RCMP officer got involved and suddenly realized what I was doing and realized what we were looking at and suddenly took off and just, I mean, didn't ask my name, nothing, just got out of there. And because my father was a pilot in the Department of Transport, my father was like me, he was a very nice guy, everybody knew him. And so when one of the people who was involved in the 75 flap was a radar tech out of the Department of Transport who had worked for Wilbur Smith. And he said to me, he says, well, you know, if you're into UFOs, you should research the Smith guy. He was the most brilliant engineer you'd ever met. But when it came to UFOs, this guy was absolutely crazy. He was talking to him every day, and they were landing in his yard and stuff. And I said, say what? And I was just absolutely amazed. So when I went inside the Department of Transport, and I'd say, I'm Bob Cameron's son. And they'd say, oh, yeah, Bob Cameron, oh, for a while. Yeah, what do you want to know? And people would tell me whatever I wanted to know. And I had people that worked for Smith who were junior techs at the time. And that's where I started to collect the stories. I went through the Canadian government, tried to force the issue with the Canadian government, and they actually interviewed one of the people in the Department of Transport, interviewed Merle Smith, who is Wilbur Smith's wife, and she agreed to talk to me. And I can still remember, I live in a city, a fairly large city, 700,000 people. We have no freeways. And I remember going to Ottawa, and it was the first time I'd ever been on an expressway, and Mrs. Smith said, well, we got to go to Jim's place, my son. We're going to go over there, and we're going to talk about this. And I said, okay, fine. And I remember we were driving along down this expressway, first time I've ever been on an expressway, and I'm trying to not run into anything, and she's talking about this AFA, and this AFA, as I'll tell you, is the alien, and AFA this, and AFA that, and I'm trying to drive, and I'm going, like, it was like, she was talking about it like it was the family pet or something, and I spent three or four hours with Merle and the son, and I'm telling you, it was like being in the Twilight Zone, and that's what this story's like, if you actually know all the stuff. Like, as you see on the last point there, I did talk with a number of members of the Inner Circle, and they would tell the same bizarre stories of what was going on. It was like a different world back there. Now, to get into Smith's background, for people who are not familiar with this guy, he gained an interest in flying saucers in 1949, 1950, reading articles, and he read Frank Scully's book on the crash flying saucers. And at that point, he decided he wanted to do something about this. He figured he had an idea of what was going on, what these things were. He was, at the time, a senior radio engineer with the Department of Transport in Canada. He was responsible for all sorts of ionospheric tests, bouncing radio waves off the ionosphere. They monitored 50,000 radio stations in Canada. They allocated, when the Canadians and the Americans negotiated FM radio stations, they had to allocate the frequencies to various stations, whatever. Wilbur Smith was the Canadian guy that was negotiating. A lot of Canadian government people later on took some shots at Smith that he wasn't all quite there. So I always don't fail to point, I always want to point out that in 1956 he was promoted, after the project finished, he was promoted to the superintendent of radio regulations inside the Department of Transport. And as far as I know, you usually don't promote the crazy guy. A very important thing, the next item that's on the list here, is he ran Radio Ottawa. I was talking to one of the Inner Circle members, and this guy was a military scientist who worked for Smith, and we were talking about security clearances, and he was clarifying me on security clearances. He basically said, forget about the secret, the top secret, and all the names on the thing. Security works on one simple principle, need to know. That you can be just a junior tech, and you can know more than the guy that's on the top if you have a need to know, and if you're working on a certain program. And he said, Wilbur Smith had a very high security clearance. He says, I don't know if you know that, outside the UFO thing. And I said, well, no, I didn't know that. He said, he ran Radio Ottawa. Do you know what Radio Ottawa was? And I said, well, no. He said, Radio Ottawa was the place where the spies radioed in. It was also the place that monitored the Russian communications, and Smith ran it. He handed out the radio frequencies. If you take intelligence agencies, they need radio frequencies. Smith was the person who allocated the radio frequencies. So Smith was a very high-powered government official, despite anything that he did with UFOs. He was also not a typical researcher. We've recovered the vast majority of Smith's files. We've got about 500 pages of letters and documents and stuff that he left. And on only two occasions does he ever really get mad at anybody. It's not like today with all the squabbling and stuff. He was a completely different type of person. He was very nice to everybody, dealt with everybody on a level playing field. This is the actual material. Smith headed Project Magnet. Project Magnet was the report that was the official study on flying saucers. It ran from 1950 to 1954. I'll talk quite a bit about it. He was also a key member of what was called Project Second Story, which was the Canadian Defense Department study on UFOs. It's been written up by a number of researchers, some highfalutin study on UFOs. It was a total whitewash, and I'm not even going to, you know, dignify you by talking about it. Smith was a member of that board. The Project Magnet report is another one that you should know about. It's very, very important. It was written in 1953, and basically what it was an interim report on Project Magnet. And it was, the conclusion is what you should know. The conclusion, written by Wilbur Smith, was based on rigid statistical analysis of the sightings coming into the Canadian government. There was a 91% probability that these objects are real. There was a 60% probability that they are extraterrestrial. The report went up. It sat on the Prime Minister's desk. The Prime Minister's are equivalent to your President of the United States. The Project Magnet report sat on the Prime Minister's desk for 3 months. At the end of 3 months, Prime Minister Saint-Laurent, who was in power at the time, decided that it probably wasn't the appropriate time to release this report, and apparently Wilbur Smith went along with it. The final item on the list there is the Flying Saucer Observatory, which Smith became somewhat famous in the United States. I think he was written up in a number of these Science Digest magazines and stuff, based upon a flying saucer observatory that Smith had built in 1953. And what it was a station where they monitored these communications, Russian communications, inside the fence. They had set up sort of like a shed there, and they had five different things they were registering, like changing gravity, changing noise. They had an ionospheric machine there. And what they could do is they could detect anything that was flying over. And, of course, Wilbur wanted to detect a flying saucer. And they would have profiles on planes. They could tell when a plane was going over based upon what kind of track it made on the paper. Later I'll talk about the Flying Saucer Observatory. It's what actually got Wilbur Smith shut down. One thing I will mention at this point was when I was talking to one of the inner circle members, the Canadian government has always said that the material that was used in there was surplus material from various departments that Wilbur was using. The one item, as told to me by an inner circle member, was that the magnetometer that was used was not surplus, it was state of the art. It was used to track submarines, and I'll refer to that again in a bit. Okay, we got a... This is the famous top secret memo. Smith is basically, I guess, known for the top secret memo. He wrote a top secret memo to the Canadian government dealing with flying saucers after a visit to the United States in 1950. And what I want you to note on the thing, on the very top above the Department of Transport, you have top secret. It's been stroked out. On the top right-hand corner, you have the final declassification of this document, which is important to note, 1979. Down on the right hand, just below there, you have a downgrading of the document in 1969 to confidential. And for now, I'm going to talk about this later, that's all you need to know. But those dates are very important dealing with this document. The top secret document I put down here, a very important point, it was obtained through discreet inquiries. And there's an S on the end of that word. A number of people writing up this story will say that Wilbur Smith went down to the United States. He talked to Dr. Robert Sawbacher, and that Robert Sawbacher told him a bunch of stuff. He went back and wrote the top secret memo. That is not true. Robert Sawbacher was one of the people Smith talked to. Wilbur Smith talked to a number of high-ranking people in the United States. Sawbacher has been somewhat famous because of his talk about UFOs at the time, association with Vannevar Bush, who headed the program, talked about this sort of stuff. He was an electrical engineer. So was Wilbur Smith. So was Dr. Eric Walker, who we later tracked down. A number of the people that were involved were electrical engineers. Sawbacher was also a freelancer. He ran a laboratory in Washington, D.C. that a lot of the high military people would go to run tests and this sort of stuff. So Sawbacher sort of knew what was going on. And Smith had, through the Canadian Embassy in Washington, had used a military attaché, and he had gone out and got a hold of Sarbacher, and they do an interview. Now, one of the points, I'm not going to talk about Walker. Walker was the guy we wrote the book on. We chased him around for 8 years, and I'm pretty sure he was quite sorry he answered the first phone call. But Sarbacher put us on to him, and Sarbacher himself was interviewed by Wilbur Smith, and the notes, I think I've got the notes on the internet, that Wilbur Smith in his files actually left the actual set of notes of the interview with Sarbacher. And one thing I should, I guess, have mentioned at this moment was the fact that a lot of the documents, for example, the top secret document that I showed you the front page of, the top secret document and a number of the other key documents, Wilbur Smith double copied them and put them in his files. He was dying of cancer. He knew he was dying. He told his wife, he said, when I die, they're coming to get the files. Wilbur Smith made arrangements to have the files hidden. He told his wife, he said, they're coming to get the files. I don't care who comes. I don't care what they tell you. You do not give up the files. Mrs. Smith told me that the minute he died, Wilbur was right. They started to come. The Canadians came looking for the files for research purposes. The Americans came looking for the files for research purposes. And the Russians came looking for the files for research purposes. Wilbur had been involved with all three, Russians, Americans, and Canadians. He had sat on the board of the International Geophysical Year in 1957. It was a big thing. All sorts of scientists around the world gathering together to run experiments. Wilbur sat on the board and had contact with these different people. And the Russians took him very seriously. The book that I showed you, the book that Wilbur Smith printed, or his wife printed after he died, half of all the copies went to Finland and were headed for the Soviet Union, of all the books that were published. Sarbacher, on this interview that I have, I'm pretty sure I have it on the website, Wilbur Smith tells Smith a number of things. He tells him, for example, flying saucers exist. He says the subject of flying saucers is classified 2 points higher than the hydrogen bomb. It's the most highly classified secret in the United States. And this is an interview that takes place, I believe, in September of 1950. The next one is a key point. I'm coming back to it later. There's no clarification as to where they're from. So remember that. He tells Smith that in order to get further material, he should get clearance. There is a second top secret memo that was in Smith's files, which doesn't appear in the government files when they were finally forced out of the Canadian government, where Smith has actually written a second top secret memo where he goes to the Canadian government and he asks for clearance. And we can now prove that he did have clearance in the United States to talk to the Americans. The top secret memo, this top point, I've just a couple days, the material just keeps rolling in, discusses a new propulsion theory. Smith had based on the Scully book, he had an idea that the Earth's geomagnetic field could be used as a source of propulsion, and he had an idea that the flying saucers were using this geomagnetic field to propel themselves. So he goes to the United States and he links up with the Americans to try to find out what the Americans know about this. Now let's hope this works, because I got to go ahead and then come back. What we've discovered, this is a geomagnetic survey map. It's produced by the US Navy. It is a map that gives the Earth's geomagnetic field. Wilbur Smith wrote the top secret memo in 1950, and the top secret memo talks about the geomagnetic theory. In an interview with Dr. Oman Salant, who was one of the key people, I won't really get into who he was, he sat at the level of the Joint Chiefs in Canada. We asked him a question, or one of the researchers asked him a question and said, was Smith's theories ever discussed with Vannevar Bush? Now, Vannevar Bush was the key U.S. guy. He was the science advisor to Roosevelt. He was the scientific administrator for some projects you may have heard about, like the atomic bomb and radar and proximity fuse and the homing torpedo, all the weapons of Second World War. Vannevar Bush was the guy who was the scientific administrator. This guy confirmed that Smith's theories were probably discussed with Vannevar Bush. This U.S. Navy project is also called Project Magnet. Now, we always thought that there was probably some connection. Now, we just discovered an article that was written by NICAP in 1963, and in this article, a fellow by the name of Beck, he worked for Major Kehoe, and he was a former Lockheed flight test engineer. And what they were doing with this thing is they would take Constellation aircraft and they would fly them in 200-mile tracks around the world, measuring the Earth's gravitational field. Beck talked to the guys that were flying it, and the guys that were flying the planes confirmed that the flying saucer project in the United States and this geomagnetic project by the U.S. Navy and the Canadian flying saucer program were closely related. And it was what we always suspected, but the key point is that the top secret memo was written in 1950, and we were always trying to find out, did Smith have clearance to talk in the United States? This program began in 1951. So it's kind of coincidental that Smith's theories are discussed with Vannevar Bush in late 1950, early 1951, and suddenly the U.S. Air Force starts running tracks and measuring the Earth's gravitational field. Not only were they listening to Wilbur Smith or talking to Wilbur Smith, they were listening to him, and they were actually running stuff to try to back or support his theory about the Earth's gravitational field. Now, let's see if I can go back here. Well, shoot. I gotta go back two slides here. Hang on. Okay, the top secret memo has always been described as having four main points. And I'm going to say it has five, and I will maintain till I die. There's five main points, and the fifth is the most important. In the top secret memo, if you read it, and it's on my website, these are the four points. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rated higher than the H-bomb. That was told to him by Sarbacher. Flying saucers exist. That was told to him by Sarbacher. Their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who I've already described. This is a key point. I'm coming back to this one as well. The fourth point is the entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. Now, just to go back one, this modus operandi thing, that was not told him by Sarbacher. It was not in the Sarbacher interview. That he got from somebody else, the whole fact that Vannevar Bush was running the program. So the fourth point, the fifth is the most important, and it's one I'm going to spend the majority of the lecture talking about. Smith says, as soon as he finishes point four, the very next words in the memo say, I was further informed that the United States authorities are investigating along quite a number of lines which might possibly be related to the saucers, such as mental phenomena. In ufology, mental phenomena, the metaphysical thing has been thrown out. We're interested in hardware, all this kind of stuff. Wilbur Smith had received information from the Americans right from the word go that mental phenomena was important. One of the things I might point out that sort of backs this theory up, the top secret memo was written in November of 1950. In 1951, in June of 1951, 100 miles down the road at McGill University in Montreal, Dr. Salant, who was involved with the Project Magnet, was in negotiations with the CIA for a project you may have heard of, MKUltra. That's where it began. And it involves mind control, and it sort of backs up the fact that the Americans were scrambling in 1950 to deal with mental phenomena. They realized that this stuff was important, and it might be connected to the saucers. Now, communication, this is the key point. The first quote there is again by Salant, who was a very high-ranking guy. And what Salant says, he confirms that Smith was very keen on communication with outer space. The second quote I have there is just to point out that Smith had some running battles. As he described it, a running battle with Major Kehoe all through the 1950s. Kehoe did not buy into contactees. In fact, in 1958, Kehoe put a message in the nightcap bulletin saying, all the contactees are to send in their memberships. You guys are out of here. We're not having anything to do with you guys. And Smith, as you can see from the quote, said to him, you're wrong, you're dead wrong. This is probably the most important aspect of the whole thing. And now I want to divert for just a second, because I can't really in good conscience go into talking about all the bizarre things about the contacts in the Canadian government without at some point defending Wilbur Smith and defending the contactees and defending this whole notion that this is not important. And I'm sort of going to read a little bit about this, and this is on the website. I have a longer version of this. As of next December, Wilbur Smith will have been dead for 40 years. And as I said, I can't really get into the weird stuff that was going on without sort of defending Wilbur Smith for doing what he did and pointing out that he did what was the right thing to do. The majority of us in this room, I think, would fit into the category that we want to establish the reality of the phenomena. And we want that reality disclosed to the American people. And I think on that point I'm right. But as much as we hate to admit it, part of what we want in this phenomena is we want vindication. We want people to stop laughing at us. We want people to think that we're in a respected field. And we think that hardware and things like this would bring us that. And I think I and everybody else would just love to have me or somebody else haul an alien up on this stage, a dead alien. We could all come up here and touch it. And we could get we could say, yes, this thing is real. Now let's take this thing and put it on national TV, and we could convince the rest of the American people that this phenomena is real. The American people would believe it. We would have established the reality of the phenomena. But I'm telling you right now, that's as far as you go. Because basically, when you come right down to it, the reality of the phenomena is only part of the story. And for the people that may be sort of squirming about this contactee thing and have some problems with it, I want to ask you a question that was asked to us. We, as I said, we chased around this Dr. Eric Walker. And Dr. Eric Walker not only knew what was going on, we're thoroughly convinced this guy knew the reasons for the secrecy. He was involved in the beginning. He knew Vannevar Bush. He knew all these people. He was basically an assistant secretary of defense at one time. He was a very, very powerful guy. And at one point, we were asking him all these questions, and we were bugging him. We were saying, come on, Walker, you're an old man. Like, do something for humanity. We were asking for some notes from a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from crash retrieval. He had some notes that he had taken at this meeting. And he held his ground. He just wouldn't give up. He wouldn't give us the proof we needed to prove the reality of the phenomena. And at one point, he got very upset with us. And he asked a question. He said, okay, now let me ask you a question. He said, you tell me this. When you get the answer to this thing, what are you going to do next? And it was a question that took me 15 years to figure out. In fact, I only figured out as I was doing this lecture what Walker was talking about. And what Walker was talking about when he said, when you get the answer, what are you going to do with it, is that if he helped us to establish the reality of the phenomena, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do with it? And basically what it comes down to is a dead alien only establishes the reality of the phenomena. A crash flying saucer only establishes the reality of the phenomena. It tells you nothing more about the phenomena than that. You may be able to rebuild a flying saucer and fly it around, but basically it does not tell you where they're from. It does not tell you why they're here. And Walker knew that, because Walker told us. He said, leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. And he told us that over and over. Research something else. He said, you're up against the windmills. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. And what he was basically saying is, the reality of the phenomena, beyond that, the American government doesn't know anything. There's nothing you can do about it. It's out of our control. Wilbur Smith said the same thing. Wilbur Smith said, and this is to quote Wilbur Smith, the fact is that when certain government people came face to face with the reality of the space people and realized there wasn't anything they could do about it, they promptly closed their eyes and hoped the whole thing would go away. That, I will absolutely bet you, everything I can put on the table to bet, is one of the main reasons why this story is not released. It is not released because of the things that the American government cannot answer and cannot control. Let me give you an example. There's a movie, there's a documentary that's coming out called Out of the Blue. It won 2 awards at the Laughlin Film Festival. And it has a new interview with Jimmy Carter. My interest is with the presidents. There's a new interview there with Jimmy Carter. And what they do with Jimmy Carter is he's very good at signing books. He can sign 400 books an hour or whatever it is. They got a guy in a wheelchair to slow a line down, and they're going to ask him a question, because Jimmy Carter will talk about his UFO sighting, but that's all he'll talk about. So they asked him about his UFO sighting. This thing is on tape. You'll see it on the documentary. And Jimmy Carter says, oh, yeah, I saw one of those things, you know, and it disappeared. And then the guy in the wheelchair says to him, he says, well, can you tell me about what did you find out when you were the president? And then Jimmy Carter suddenly realizes this thing is kind of a setup, and he's being taped. And he says this. He says, there are many possibilities, but nobody has any answers. And again, it defines this phenomena, that you can get the reality of the phenomena. You can get a dead alien, which the government has. You can get the crash flying saucers, which they have. But all you do is establish the phenomena. Now, let me make one final... Well, let me first spell out why it's important that Smith is defended on this. Wilbur Smith knew the reality of the phenomena. I will show you. I'll play you tapes today to show you that Wilbur Smith had seen the crash flying saucers. Smith had seen the dead alien bodies. Smith had handled a whole pile of hardware, mysterious hardware. Every sighting that came into the Canadian government for 12 years went across his desk. He had talked to top U.S. government officials, and basically when it all came down to it, he said, I'm not getting anywhere. He knew the reality of the phenomena, but he said, we basically aren't getting anywhere. And if you take a look at those 2 points that I pointed back about Sarbacher, he asked Sarbacher. He says, do flying saucers exist? Sarbacher says, yeah, they exist. And Smith says, next question, well, where are they from? Sarbacher says, we don't know where they're from. We just know we didn't build them. They had no idea where they were from. The other thing was the modus operandi is unknown. They don't know why they're here. The Americans had the crash flying saucers. They had the bodies, but they didn't know what was going on. So basically what it comes down to is until somebody starts talking to an alien, we aren't going anywhere. And that's the fact. I'll point out one more thing and then I'll move on to show you how concrete this thing is. Most of us want George W. Bush to stand up and make a disclosure. We have disclosure conferences. We have people writing campaign letters, you know, to George Bush. If George Bush were to stand up and say UFOs are real and they're extraterrestrial, I will guarantee you within 5 minutes somebody in the Washington Press Corps will ask the following question. Mr. Bush, it has been estimated that thousands, if not millions of people have been abducted by these aliens you're talking about. Mr. Bush, what are you doing to stop it? Mr. Bush does not only know not how to, he not only does not know how to stop it, he doesn't even know why it's happening. And the U.S. government will never admit something that they can't control. They are the superpower on the earth, and George Bush will never disclose this thing because they just don't have the answers. And he's dead in the water if he goes up there and looks like a dummy who can't control the... Okay, some may say, and justifiably so, that the material coming from the contactees has got a lot of garbage in it. And Smith said this, and it's a justifiable thing to bring up. It's what they call a high noise to signal ratio. But we are the researchers, and we are the people that are responsible for setting up protocols. And I think we're smart enough. We had the problem with remote viewing that they were getting a lot of garbage, and they learned in remote viewing how to get rid of the noise and get the actual signal. And I think rather than kicking the contactee in the head, people like Wilbur Smith and all these different people, that we have to develop some sort of protocol to study these people, and we have to find some way to get rid of the noise and actually talk to the aliens. Because basically when it comes down to it, if you want to know where they're from, if you want to know why they're here, and if you want to know why they're abducting people, and you want to know how to stop them from abducting people, if that's your thing, sooner or later you're going to have to talk to the aliens. This isn't Afghanistan. You can't bomb these people. They're the ones with the power. Okay, now on communication. Smith was a contactee. I released this in the mid-1970s after talking to Mrs. Smith, and a lot of people didn't really believe it. Even now, a lot of people really don't know that he was a contactee. He was a contactee from the very beginning. A lot of people will say, well, there was a story going around he had brain tumor and that he got kind of strange at the end. The fact is actually the opposite. The contacts all occurred at the beginning of the research when he was running the UFO program. At the end, Wilbur Smith said he really didn't have a contact in the last 2 years. The aliens, they seemed to go away. He said, I'm saving up questions. I haven't talked to him for 2 years, or I haven't had a contact with these people for 2 years. So it all happened at the beginning. The two aliens that were involved, actually, I've got this wrong. Afa was the main alien. We're going to talk about him a lot. Tyla was an alien that was supposedly the garbage collector. He was flying around wiping up nuclear fallout from the atomic tests. Afa was the key, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about him. How the communication was done. Wilbur Smith had an expression that said, God provided, man divided. And basically, if you came to Wilbur Smith and said, I'm talking to an alien, Wilbur Smith would say, have a seat, tell me how you're doing it. You could be the guy I want to talk to. You tell me how you're doing this. Do you think you can teach us how to do this? And what he would also say to the guy is, I've got 100 questions here. I want you to go and take them to your alien and ask your alien these questions. The actual human contact, Smith said, he never actually met these people face to face, and he was desperate to meet these people. He was trying to get somebody, get them to land, get them. Tell them I want to talk to them. Everybody that would come in that said they'd talk to aliens, tell them I want to talk to these people. I want to meet them face to face. The second method that was used, there was a number of methods. The second and the third sort of go together. The radio and the coil. As I said, Wilbur Smith was a radio expert. He had 37 patents. His wife said 36 of them the Canadian government stole. The majority of radio equipment that was in the Department of Transport planes was built by Smith. He was a radio expert. He, with monitoring, with building stuff, and of course he was very tied into trying to contact these aliens by radio. One of the stories was told to me by was this radio tech told me a story. It was kind of funny. He said this was in the spring of 1953. He was at Shirley's Bay, which is where the monitoring station was, and he went there, and he said the parking lot was full. It was Sunday afternoon. He couldn't figure out why the parking lot was so full, and he went into the station, and they were sitting at the big radio transmitter, and there's a bunch of people gathered around, and here they are, they're going to talk to AFA. And the guy that was running the thing, I interviewed him. His name was Gil Bolger. He was the guy that was in charge of the radio. And Smith says, well, okay, let's make this communication. And Bolger says, this is an illegal communication. I'm not making it. This is a licensed Canadian station, and we're not making this communication. I'm not going to do it. And Smith says, come on, make this communication. No, I'm not going to do it. And there's this big showdown, and eventually the communication was not made, or they didn't try to put it through. I talked to Gil Bolger later, and he told me this whole story about how Smith was trying to get him to make this communication. And I said to him, I says, well, does AFA ring a bell with you? Do you know who AFA is? Oh, AFA, man, I heard about that guy all the time. I was getting sick of hearing about that AFA guy. He says, I used to say to him, AFA pint, have another beer, Wilbur. So the coil was tied into this. Smith got from the boys' top side, he called them, he got a design for a coil that would help them with the radios. And what it would do, it would create a donut-shaped wave and that the aliens could lock into. So he had this coil, and Smith was building this thing, and he sort of an important principle behind this. He was building this coil, and he was sending it to all the contactees of the day, Adamski, Fry, Williamson, Van Tassel, all these guys, and he would send them this thing, and he'd say, you know, use this thing and try to contact the aliens, and he would tell them how to build this thing, and the contactees would all write back, these letters are all in his files, would write back and say, well, you know, we can't get this thing, it's not working, and so Wilbur, of course, would build this thing for them. He would wind these coils, and he would send it back, and then they would come back, and they would say, you know, Wilbur, what are we doing wrong? We just can't get this thing to work. Can you tell us? And Wilbur would say, come on. He says, they just gave us this thing. They're not here to do our homework. You know, like, come on, you got to do something for yourself. They're not going to do it. They've given us this thing, and it's up to us that they're just leading us along. They're not actually going to drop technology in our lap. So this coil actually did work at one point, because Smith does refer, if you look at the quote section that I've referred to, the quotes on the handout, Smith talks about a number of communications with the aliens done by radio. Sleep message is a very important one. When I was talking to the fellow who did the metallurgist and the metal work for Smith, he told me, I asked him, I said, how did Smith contact the aliens? He told me, well, Smith would keep a pad beside his bed at night. And he'd wake up in the morning, and all the stuff would be written down on the pad. Wilbur would have gotten up in the middle of the night and written all this stuff down. And then he'd come into the lab in the morning, he'd say, oh, AFA's been busy. And he'd show the pad, and AFA says, we've got to do this, AFA says, we've got to do that. And that was, according to the metal guy, that was how a lot of the stuff came through, was through this pad thing that was being used. The telex operator is probably the best story of the contacts. There was a blind telex operator in the Ottawa area who was getting messages on his telex from AFA. And he got in contact with Smith, and he would transfer these messages. The one particular message was in 1959. They were working on a gravity control experiment, which I'll refer to later. And they were about to test this thing. And they had this thing, it was a plate. And they were rotating this plate at 15 to 18,000 revs a minute. And it was really moving. And they were about to test this thing when the phone rings. And they were either in the garage or the basement. I can't remember where the experiment was set up. And the metal guy was in the room, and he was telling me what happened. And he said it was the blind telex operator. And the blind telex operator says, Wilbur, we got a message from the alien, from AFA. And all he says is, shield the experiment. Wilbur says, okay, fine, thanks. Hangs up the phone. He says, okay, guys, got it. That's it. Shut her down. We got to shield this thing. So they got a bunch of bricks, and they built what was called a well. They built a huge wall around this anti-gravity experiment and started it up. And, of course, the thing exploded. And Wilbur talks in his, he doesn't talk about the blind telex operator, but he does talk about this thing exploding in his letters, and he says, it's a good thing we were warned about this thing. He says, we were picking ceramic magnets out of the walls for days. So that was one of the things, the blind telex operator. Other contactees, as I said, he was in contact with all the contactees of the day, Adamski, Fry, all these guys. And he was basically, he would send them all this questionnaire of 100 to 125 questions. And what he would do is compare the questionnaires scientifically, and he would see, everybody was talking to athlete, put all the questionnaires together, and he'd see whether all the answers to the different questions agreed. And he dealt with a lot of them, and he realized there was this problem of noise to signal ratio. Letters was one that I discovered, and it just blew me away. Wilbur Smith talks about a letter he got from AF, and I couldn't figure it out, so I asked his son about it. And basically what it was there was a main contact that he had, which is the woman at the end there, Mrs. Swan. They would send the letter to Mrs. Swan. She would read it to the alien, and the alien would tell her what the answer was, and the letter would be mailed back. Mrs. Swan, I'm going to talk about, as when I talk about the 54 satellites tomorrow, I'm going to talk about Mrs. Swan. Mrs. Swan, I call her the star quarterback of the AFA team. Mrs. Swan is a woman you could write a book on. Not many people know about her. She is one amazing story. And a number of government departments in the U.S. dealt with her as well. But she was one. She was the main way that Smith contacted with the boys' top side. Better see how much time I got here. Holy shoot. Okay, hardware. I'm missing time. I've been abducted here. Okay, now we get into the hardware. Wilbur Smith handled a lot of hardware. There's some stories that some of it was counterintelligence. I don't think that's really true. He handled an awful lot. When I sat with this metallurgist guy, and he was a very scary type of guy, we'd go into a room, and he would sit in there, and his family would have to leave the room, and then he'd close the door, and I asked him, and he did the metal analysis. I said to him, Art, I said, can you tell me, how much material did you and Wilbur actually analyze, UFO material? And he paused, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, lots of it. There was various samples. I have a lot on my website. I have a lot of stuff on hardware. And it gets into details about, you know, the material's harder, and it's this, that. It's your standard hardware type stuff. You can read it on there. I'm not going to get too much into the describing this piece or describing that piece. Wilbur Smith mentioned to one of the Inner Circle member peoples, there was a room in the Pentagon where the small hardware was kept, the small pieces that were being sent to him, and they also had documents. And I don't know whether he was ever in the room. He just mentioned there was a room in the Pentagon where this stuff was being kept. Now I'm going to play some tapes, and I'm just going to play one after another. And this is other people talking about hardware. The first one is a tape of Wilbur Smith's son, who was, when Wilbur Smith died, he was 19 years old. And he's going to describe what he, his sister, and his brother saw going on inside the Smith household during the 1950s. And this deals with hardware.
I remember, many times I do remember, blue military cars pulling up to the house and leaving packages of things for him to do metallurgical analysis on. And we'd asked him what they were, and he said they were chunks that unidentified things that the military had either shot down or found.
Unidentified things? Or did he actually use the word flying saucers? Or
yes. Yeah. On a couple of instances, I remember packages about the size of a loaf of bread coming in. The box would contain a chunk of metal that he'd been told that the Air Force had shot a chunk off of a flying saucer, and they'd already done some analysis of it. Uh-huh. And would like to him to have a go at it too. So
now, was this the American Air Force, the Canadian Air Force?
Well, I don't remember what color the plate it was, but I mean, it came from the States, whether it was delivered to the house by a Canadian.
So it came from the States. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. On more than one occasion, there were these pieces that were sent in?
On several occasions, and they'd be of different sizes, and there was no regularity to it at all. Mm. He'd send them away for analysis and try to cut pieces off them and do what he could as well.
Yeah.
Some of those pieces you were saying, some came in the mail, some came by military vehicle.
Yes.
So there was a number of them that were arriving.
Yeah.
You actually saw some of these pieces as well, Jim?
Oh, yes. Okay. And I saw them when you unpacked the box and what's in there and take a look at it.
Hmm. How old would you have been then?
Looking at 10 to 17 in my age group.
Did you get an opportunity to handle any of them? How would you know what was an unusual-looking piece of metal at the age of...
I got to handle
17.
A few of them. One was a chunk about the size of a brick, semicircular in shape, a very smooth metal, except where the jagged edges of where it had been disconnected from whatever it belonged to. It was quite heavy in terms of its size. He had analysis done of that one. I remember seeing that particular analysis sheet come back, and there were a few things in there that they're not found on this planet.
presumably that paperwork was secret and he wouldn't have kept any copies of the analysis.
Well, I don't know where it would have gone.
Mm. All of the artifacts or all of these materials, I take it, had been returned at some particular point in time?
Well, he would send them back.
Mm. That's unfortunate. Would be nice to have one.
Well, he probably cut off a cubic inch or something. We'd hang on to that. But,
mm-hmm.
Jim, you mentioned that he was shown bodies at one point, or something.
Yeah, on one of the times he was in the States a lot, partly due to his work as a superintendent of radio regulations. So he had to deal with frequency allocations and channels and radio and that sort of business. So he was frequently on committees in the States where they were working out joint frequency allocations, for example. And on several occasions, he was invited off to be shown things along this line. That was pretty well under the Official Secrets Act, he told us. However, when he just before he passed away at 62, he felt the act couldn't get him any more than that. So I did ask him, and he said yes, he saw the bodies.
And he had several connections with the high-ranking military folks, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
One of them was Rear Admiral Knowles, I believe.
Yes, we were at the Knowles home on many occasions.
Yeah. And he was with, was it the Office of Naval Intelligence?
Yes.
Right, so there was opportunity there for this type of thing to be legitimate. He wasn't just, you know, mm-hmm. he was told these things were there, and he saw them.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to be a fly on the wall at those social gatherings, wouldn't it?
Unbelievable, well, yeah. Did he describe them at all? Do you recall any
description? Not that I can recall, except that the descriptions that had sort of been out and about were fairly accurate.
The descriptions that were out and about were fairly accurate.
Do we have descriptions of grays at that time?
I think there were descriptions of smallish types. I don't know about necessarily the coloring, but...
No, I don't remember a lot of those details.
Mm-hmm.
I just read that it satisfied my curiosity that he had seen them and that they were real.
Okay, just to make a point on this, this interview at the very end, the last slide, has an address. This is about 4 minutes from a 45-minute interview with Wilbur Smith's son. The address for that, you can listen to it on the internet. It's a bizarre interview. You can follow up on that. The other point I want to make is there's discussion there. They said, were there grays in the 50s? And the answer is no, there wasn't grays in the 50s, and the bodies were not grays. I talked to Jim Smith about this as well. They were basically small people. That's the way Wilbur Smith described them. The next interview I'm going to do here, I'm just going to play two small clips, if I can get it right. This was a fellow by the name of Bob Groves, was out of the Ohio group. This is a 60-minute tape. I think I'm probably the only person alive who has this tape. It was provided to me by the Ohio people. He interviewed Wilbur Smith when Wilbur Smith was dying. He was sick already. And in July of 1962, and Wilbur gave him an interview. And he goes into the hardware sections of this tape are sort of split up. So I'm going to play you two small sections. But he goes into a lot of detail about what Smith told him about what was going on. These are two small clips on hardware.
During the actual operation, however, of this, when Mr. Smith was on his feet, he was constantly visited by both Canadian government officials as well as American government officials. These were, of course, upper echelon people with attaché cases that were chained and locked to their wrists to make sure, of course, that none of the information was dropped or left behind in a station, a bus station or something. And so he had a number of these visits. They had samples they wanted him to analyze of hardware, that is actually metal that had been found. They often made many statements. I might mention some of the statements that had been made.
Okay, that's the first section. The second section, he talks about... Just cue it ahead here. The second section he's going to talk about, the 1952 piece, which is a piece that Wilbur had said had been shot off by the U.S. One story has the Navy, one has the Air Force shooting it off over Washington in 1952. Wilbur handled this piece, And it is one of the pieces that when he was interviewed by the Ohio group, they asked him, did you send it back to the Air Force? And Wilbur says no. Wilbur said a number of times, the Air Force does not handle this stuff. That's not where the hardware is. He said, I sent it someplace else. And they said, well, was it to the CIA? And he said it was a small, highly classified group. And you have to establish their identity for them, for yourself. This is talking about the 1952 piece.
A little bit late, perhaps, but something we can edit in here. Some of the factual material concerning that chunk. First of all, we're getting back to radio again, an initial resonance. That is, when it was found, this unidentified chunk of material actually had a radio frequency resonance of 4.5 megacycles. That is, it actually had a sensitivity to 4.5 megacycles. This was when it was, however, initially found. After a while, it had lost. After that 2 weeks, when it had gone down to its dull brown color, it had lost its initial 4.5 megacycle radio resonance and had also lost an initial high magnetic permeability. It was very, very magnetic when it was first found. The material itself was magnesium orthosilicate. This was the matrix of the material, magnesium orthosilicate. And upon microscopic examination, it was found to contain thousands of little tiny spheres that were embedded all through the matrix. And these little spheres, we don't know why they're there, but they were in the construction, were approximately 15 microns in diameter, and they were dimpled. Each one had a slight dimple in one side of it. According to Mr. Smith, the United States military intelligence has tons of hardware. They had readily admitted to this upon interview by Mr. Smith during the time he was director of this research project in Canada, and they have much film.
Okay, that's basic discussion of 52 piece. There's a lot of material. There's some discussion. We're actually working on this right now, whether there was one piece or two piece. One analysis, the CIA also had a piece which went to Wilbur Smith. It was transported back by a guy by the name of Captain Donald Goodspeed. We know about that. It was 1954 they transferred that piece back. And Wilbur Smith also handled that, and he sent the analysis back to the Central Intelligence Agency. But we're working on right now whether there's one piece or whether there's two pieces. There's some confusion. The final thing I'm going to play is just a very small section. It was done last Sunday night with Jim Smith. It's just confirming a story. The fellow that I'm going to refer to on here, Buck Buchanan, was one of the Inner Circle members.
One of the things I wanted to confirm.
Yeah.
The other thing is Buchanan told a story about crash flying saucers, like you mentioned the bodies.
Yeah.
And I have a story about your father seeing a crash saucer at a Air Force base outside of Washington.
That's right.
Did you ever hear that story?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that is. Okay. Your father told you that, or you just heard that from one of the other people?
No, my dad told me that.
Okay.
Okay, that's just to deal with the story that I don't think has really been released. The fact that Wilbur had seen a crash flying saucer, and which showed that he did have very high level contacts in the United States. Now, just to get to the last two pieces, the 54 piece, 52-54 piece, I have a lot on the website. You want to read about that. The St. Lawrence slabs, I'm going to do in just 1 second. The last piece on there is the Roswell. The metal guy, when the 1987, when the MJ-12 documents came out, I sent him the MJ-12 documents, and I sent him the material where Sarbacher was talking about the aliens and what they looked like and stuff that he had remembered from what he had overheard in the Navy building when all these guys were coming back from this meeting at Wright-Patterson. And this guy was very paranoid, as I told you, and he never really wanted to talk, and suddenly he phoned me, and he was on the phone, and he said to me, he was shocked at Sarbacher describing these bodies as being insect-like. He said, well, we never talked about that. I never heard of that, any such thing. That just blew me away when I read that. And then he said, and that Roswell thing that you described there, that Roswell piece, that super light stuff, he says, I'll tell you right now, we handled that stuff. Now, the St. Lawrence slabs was Wilbur. That's a terrible picture of it. I'll get a better picture someday. It's a piece that appeared on the shore of the St. Lawrence River. There's actually two pieces. One was 3,000, one was 800 pieces. It was layered. It was layered between a tenth of an inch and 8/10 of an inch thick. And these pieces, it was all sort of in slabs. Smith described the fact that it had what appeared to be micrometeorites embedded on the outside of this thing. They were just fascinated. There's been piles and piles of studies on this material. They tried to cut this material. It would flare up. They tried an acetylene torch, and it would sort of flare up like an atomic bomb and started to expand and stuff, and they stopped doing that. They couldn't cut it with the normal saws and stuff like that, and they had to chip pieces off. It was a very, very bizarre thing, but I don't think anything was... It's still around. It's in somebody's yard. I'm not sure exactly where it is right now, but there's still a few of these pieces floating around. Wilbur was very impressed with this piece of metal, but I just mentioned it. It was found on the St. Lawrence River just one day up the shore, and there was lots of discussion, lots of people analyzing this, and the government was involved, and I don't know if they ever really rectified, but it was one of the pieces Smith talked about an awful lot. Okay, myths. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. How he died, there's always been a rumor. Phil Klass had the story. Well, you know, you can believe what Wilbur Smith says because, you know, he died of a brain tumor, and he died of lower bowel cancer. He did not die of a brain tumor. That story is been going around for years. He didn't head an official investigation. He was the head. What happened was in 1954, when the project was shut down, he was allowed to continue using government labs on his own, but he had to do it as a part-time project. So when the government wrote it up in 1968, they sort of left out the first part about the official government program, and they said, well, we sort of believe it was something Smith did in his spare time. And everybody else who would answer questions on Project Magnet would read this 68 report and say, well, it was a part-time project, which got to the story that it wasn't an official project. It was an official project. It was classified secret, and it had three full-time engineers working for it. I have embassy documents on the website where you see them talking about what's actually going on. And at the end of the top secret memo, when Smith puts this top secret memo, you see his boss say, okay, go ahead with it and keep me informed. So it was an official project. He didn't have access to American super secrets. He sure did have access to American super secrets. He had seen the bodies. He had talked to a number of the top people. The top secret memo should not have been top secret. I'll spend a couple seconds about this because this is one of the things that Dr. Salant, who carries a lot of weight, had come and said, well, I understand Smith put this on his personal papers, put top secret, and he really didn't have authority to put top secret on his personal papers. If that is so, why did they not declassify the document? First of all, why is it in the government files? If it's his personal papers, why is it in the government files? And it was not declassified till 1979. It was, was top secret till 69. That's actually a mistake. It was moved down to secret in January of 1951, but it remained secret until 1969. In 1969, the Department of Transport, the Department of Defense was asked to declassify all the documents by a guy who was just a total idiot, didn't know what he was Dr. Peter Millman. And Millman hadn't read anything in there, and so this guy gets the material, and he sees the project magnet report that says 60% chance these things are extraterrestrial, or probability they're extraterrestrial, and sees the top secret memo, says it's the most highly classified secret. And on my website, I have what's called the declassification memo. It's interesting to read. It was written in 1969, the same time Blue Book was being shut down. The Canadians were shutting their project down, and they were going to tell the Canadian people, there's nothing to this, you know, it's a waste of time. We're not going to spend any more money on UFO investigation. And in this memo, two of the points he makes are, when he sees the top secret memo, he says, well, this is the discussion behind Project Magnet, and he underlines it. He said, at no time should this be made available to the public. Then he refers to the Project Second Story report, and he says the report that's in the file is the original, and it should not be destroyed until such time as this subject has cooled down. And that was when they were closing the projects. Both the Americans and the Canadians were closing the projects. I just talked about that. Oh, this is still in here. Okay, hang on. I cut that. Okay, now we're into stories. How much time have I got? 25 minutes. I can get a few in. Okay, Mrs. Swan, I'm going to talk about more tomorrow. I'm just going to tell you one story. This is a very bizarre story we're working on. I've got a guy from NIDS who I've found has a file on Mrs. Swan that's as big as I have. And we've decided we're going to get to the bottom of this story. One of the stories that's told is it involves the Central Intelligence Agency. Mrs. Swan was a woman who started receiving messages in 1953 from MAFA. And there was a bunch of people. There were George Hunch Williamson was in contact with AFA. There was this telex operator. There was a whole series of people who were in contact with AFA. But Mrs. Swan was the key person. Mrs. Swan is getting these messages starting in 1953. And in 1954, the Office of Navy Intelligence, the head of the Office of Navy Intelligence, starts looking at her case. They send two guys from Washington, and their cover story is that they're trying to get airtime or flight time. They fly up to Elliott, Maine, is where she lived, and just as a side point, she lived within 5 miles of Betty Hill, and there's a story I have on the website called Good Alien, Bad Alien, and it's a very interesting story, and it involves Mrs. Hill and Mrs. Swan. Mrs. Swan had these Navy officers, Navy intelligence officers, come to the house, and one of them said, "Boy, I'd like to do this. Can you show me how to do this?" She said, "Well, yeah." So he sat down in the chair. She put her hand on his right arm. And this was done by automatic writing. And suddenly his hand started to go, and he's writing out this message. And it was signed AFA. And Mrs. Swan said, "That's not the AFA. That's the evil ones. You're in contact with the evil ones. You don't listen to those people. You're talking to the wrong person." And this gets into the whole story about the evil versus the good alien. And Mrs. Hill, and it's a very interesting story. But anyway, she tried to discourage him, but he wouldn't have nothing. He thought this was the greatest thing. He went running back to Washington, and he went to what's called the Naval Photographic Interpretation Center, which is the most highly classified photographic lab in the United States at the time. It was the lab that analyzed all the U-2 photographs and all the SR-71 photographs. It was run by a guy by the name of Arthur Lundahl, who is a key person. Some people may not have heard of him. He was a key person in the UFO thing. In fact, that 52-54 piece, Lundahl handled that. The piece that was inside the CIA was brought to him, and he looked at it. He was the guy that ran the Navy photographic lab when the Robertson panel was in session in 1953. He did all the photographic analysis work. He was in charge of it for the Robertson panel. He was the top expert on UFOs. He supposedly briefed at least three presidents on UFOs. He was a very high-ranking fellow. Todd Zeckel, who started the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy in the 1970s, knew him, said he had been in his house. He said it was the biggest UFO library he'd ever seen in his life. He said it looked like the guy had every book that had ever been published on UFOs. Anyway, this Navy intelligence officer goes racing back to Washington. He goes up to this Naval Photographic Interpretation Lab, and he goes to Arthur Lundahl, and he says, look, and he tells him the whole story about what happened and whatever. So they sit him down in a chair, and this guy goes into trance, and he starts channeling this AFA. So Art Lundahl, who is won the National Security Council Award for discovering the missiles in Cuba, was the guy who went into Kennedy's office and briefed Kennedy on the missile Cuban crisis, starts asking him these questions. And he's saying, you know, they're asking him questions like the orbit, how far away from the sun is the orbit of Jupiter? And he's answering all these questions, very technical questions. They are very impressed. And so Lundahl says to him, he says, "Well, it's very nice that you're talking to us, but can we have proof that you exist?" AFA says, "What do you want?" Lundahl says, "Can you show yourself?" AFA says, "When?" Lundahl says, "Now." AFA says, "Go to the window." They go to the window, these Navy intelligence guys and Arthur Lundahl, and this flying saucer flies by. And the latest story I heard, apparently through Valet, who interviewed Lundahl, was it was sitting right above the Capitol. Now, in later interviews, Lundahl is interviewed by this a number of times, and he denies this story. He absolutely says, "Absolutely, in no way did I see a UFO fly by the window, and absolutely, this is garbage. I felt sorry for this poor guy. If his officials had known that he was into this kind of stuff, he would have lost his job," and he denies the whole thing. But apparently, he did confirm it to Jacques Vallée that he did see the object go by the window. He writes a memo that Robert Emmenager, when they were putting this documentary together in the 1970s, and he wrote a book, he talks about this memo, this CIA memo, where Arthur Lundahl writes up this entire bizarre story about this alien and flying by the window and all this sort of stuff. And what happens is they call in Major Friend, who was at the time the temporary head of Blue Book. Friend is flown from Wright-Patterson to Washington. 2 days later, they have a meeting inside this CIA lab. He tells him the whole story. Friend is quite impressed with his whole story. Friend says, okay, let's get the guy in the room. Let's put him back in trance and let's talk to the alien. So they do the same thing for 15, 20 minutes. Friend, the head of Blue Book, is sitting in there. Arthur Lundahl, CIA intelligence officers, the whole bit, they're all sitting in this room and they're channeling this alpha. And Friend, they try to get the alien to fly by again. And alpha just says, the time isn't right. So everything goes, and Friend said something to the effect, I won't quote him, but he said something to the effect that of all the stuff he saw in Blue Book, this is one of the most impressive things he'd ever seen. Friend goes back, Friend writes a memo to his commander, who I just forgot his name, General Dugan was his commander. He writes a letter telling him about, my goodness, they've got another meeting set up and they're going back to Washington again, and we got to do something. This woman should be investigated. This is just a bizarre case. Tells him the whole CIA story. And he leaves this memo on his desk, and J. Allen Hynek apparently was at the site, I guess, at the same time, or maybe they left it out on purpose, I don't know. But anyway, Hynek is in the office, and they're in a meeting, and this memo is sitting on the top of the desk, and Hynek is reading this whole story about this woman channeling this alien thing, so he handwrites this entire memo. Now, we've finally recovered the entire thing, this memo that was written to the general. The CIA memo, Robert Emmernagar had it. Now we're trying to pin it down. There was an article done in the late 70s where Coleman, who was the spokesman for Blue Book, had said that he had seen the memo and it was legitimate. It was a legitimate CIA memo describing this incident inside this lab. I contacted Coleman and I said, did you see the memo and was it legitimate? He wrote me back and he backed off a bit. He said it looked legitimate, and even despite that, he said whatever Robert Friend goes, because his word is impeccable. So that's the one story. That Mrs. Swan, there's stories like that all over the place. This Navy intelligence officer, in fact, one of the security guys for the Aeronautics Bureau inside the Navy Department had an association with Mrs. Smith that lasted for 30 years at least. This Navy guy that did the channeling thing had an association that lasted till 1979, and he wrote a letter back to Mrs. Swan, and he said this alien had ruined his life. He was dreaming about this alien. The alien wouldn't leave him. And she told him, I told you so. You shouldn't have listened to that. You didn't listen to me. I told you that was the evil ones, and you wouldn't listen to me. And I asked her to confirm this. I said, I wrote Mrs. Swan when she was still alive, and I said, did you have an agreement with the U.S. Navy to be quiet? And she said, yes, there was an agreement to be still. She actually, the U.S. Navy intelligence worked with this woman for years. The final contact is a story that's up there. The final contact involves the Flying Saucer Observatory. What Smith was trying to do is he was trying to get a UFO to fly by. There's FBI documents that deal with Mrs. Swan. J. Edgar Hoover handled this case for the FBI. It was on J. Edgar Hoover's desk. There's a memo that was provided to him that gave the details of Mrs. Swan and the stuff that she was able to do and this sort of stuff. And in this memo, they discuss the fact that Smith is there. It's blacked out, but if you know who's involved and who's in the room, you know that Wilbur Smith was in the room at the time. And Wilbur Smith is trying to make an arrangement through Mrs. Swan to get AFA to fly. He always was trying to get AFA to fly by and land. I want to talk to this guy. I want to see this guy. And Smith said he knew what AFA looked like. He said, if I saw him on the street, I would know him. They were able to project mental images into his mind of equipment and themselves. And he said, I would know AFA if I saw him on the street. But he was trying to get them to land. And August the 1st, 1954, according to the FBI document, AFA was supposed to fly by and radio. There was going to be a radio contact with Smith. They were going to try to fly by the Flying Saucer Observatory. Well, AFA, as always happened, AFA was always late for everything. And AFA didn't appear on August the 1st. Exactly 1 week later, Smith had run this Flying Saucer Observatory for a year and nothing happened. On the 8th, exactly 1 week after this FBI contact thing was supposed to have taken place, Smith is in the observatory, and in the quotes you'll see him talking about this, what happened. I heard it from one of the radar techs who was in the room, and he said the bells went off, and the machines were just, the needles were just going all over the place, and they knew this was no plane. They had never seen this type of signature on the stuff. And they ran outside, and they looked up, and there was a 1,000-foot ceiling for the clouds. So whatever it was above the clouds. So Wilbur Smith could never confirm. The press got involved. This was August the 8th, August the 9th. The press got involved. Smith had said, well, we don't know for sure, but if the machine wasn't working, we might have detected the first flying saucer over Ottawa. Now, this is the official Canadian government guy. And, of course, the media goes, the government has detected flying saucer over Ottawa, and the very next day they shut down Project Magnet, and that was the end of it, the very next day. And Smith did blame well-meaning journalists for his demise. The anti-gravity experiment. The anti-gravity experiment Smith worked on a great deal. It was a plate. It was a copper plate. And what his idea was that if you could get a rotating magnetic field, that it would produce anti-gravity. So what they did is they got this 6-inch plate, and what they did was they cut a part of the plate out, and they would stand up ceramic magnets into the plate around the edge of the plate. So they would have a wall of ceramic magnets going around this thing. And it was ceramic magnets. Instead of having the polarity on the top and the bottom, it had it on the faces of the magnets. So you'd have, I don't know what it was, all the positives on the outside or all the negatives on the outside. And they would spin this plate at, 15, 17, 18,000 revs a minute, and they would weigh this thing, and it would weigh less. He said we could prove that we could monkey with gravity, that we could actually change gravity, and they were weighing this plate. Now, near the end, Mrs. Smith talks about the fact that the Canadian government stole 36 of his patents, that the only one that he ever got through they bought a car with, and the government was absolutely furious. That Wilbur Smith, they figured that because he worked for the Canadian government, anything that he developed in terms of radio equipment was developed on Canadian government time and with their material. And she said they would actually, once he drew the plans out for something, she said they would actually walk into the house, down the stairs, and take the equipment and walk out. Now, so at the end, Wilbur Smith had this anti-gravity thing. He took it to a guy by the name of Dr. Rose at the National Research Council. And he went to Rose, he said, I've got this thing, I can actually show that we can tinker with gravity and this thing works. And Rose says, okay, Wilbur, he says, write it up and we'll take a look at it. And he said, no, you come and take a look at it or I'll bring it down here and you guys can do some tests on it. And he said, no, Wilbur, write it up. Wilbur says, I'm not writing it up, because he knew as soon as he wrote it up, that was the end of it, they would take it. So his wife told me, Wilbur came home that day. He said, the world is not ready for this. He took it apart. And she said he never, ever spoke about it again in his life. And he had worked on this thing for years. He just said, the world is not ready for it. That was the anti-gravity experiment. The last story I can get in here is the government meets AFA. It's a very bizarre story, and it sort of indicates there may be a second project. There may actually have been a top-secret program. During 1954... If you recall back, Eisenhower, there was a rumored story that Eisenhower had been to Edwards Air Force Base to meet with live aliens. The story has sort of changed in the last couple of years to dead bodies. It was live aliens. It was always live aliens. And that was February the 20th of 1954. In 1954, Prince Philip was supposed to have had some sort of contact. They were setting up a contact through a retired general. The Canadians were also trying to land a UFO at what is our equivalent Area 51. It's called Suffield Station. It's in Alberta. It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's a restricted fly zone. It has basically like Area 51. They did chemical weapon research. I would talk to different people trying to get material out of there, and guys said, I don't know anything about the UFOs, but you find out about that town. They blew up a town. We were there. They blew up a town and some guy got killed, and they were trying to sort of simulate a nuclear explosion, and they did all sorts of bizarre stuff at this site. And there was a story came out in 1967, the Minister of Defense in Canada, the Canadians in 1967 was the Canadian Centennial. And every little town has their little centennial project. They build a rink or they build a building and it's their centennial project. St. Paul, Alberta decided their centennial project would be a UFO landing base. So they built this UFO landing base, and I don't know how this guy got roped into this, but the secretary, we call him the Minister of Defense, shows up to open this UFO landing base. So he comes there and he says, oh, this is kind of interesting because 13 years ago, the Canadian government actually opened a base for UFOs to land, and nothing ever landed there. So for whatever reason, the researchers in 1967 didn't pick up the story. I picked it up in the mid-1970s. I started writing this Paul Hellyer, this minister, and I said, well, it sort of puzzles me. You opened this base for UFOs to land. The obvious question is, how do the UFOs know where to land? Canada's a big place. I think now it may be the biggest country in the world that the Russians have broken up. But it's a huge, huge country and a lot of open space, and it always puzzled me. So when I went to meet with Mrs. Smith in 1977, I took the article, which was printed in a number of major dailies in Canada, and I took it to Mrs. Smith because I sort of figured I knew what was going on, and I said, "Can you read this article?" And she reads the article. Yeah, they built this UFO landing base for UFOs to land, and Kehoe actually talks about this. And I said, "Was Wilbur involved?" And she said, "Yeah, he was involved." She said, I said, "Well, can you tell me what happened?" She said, there was a group. There was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, there was the Department of Defense, and there was the Prime Minister of Canada were involved. Wilbur had convinced them to a point that he was in contact with an alien, and if people would quit shooting at him, Wilbur might be able to get this guy to land. So the agreement was made. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Department of Defense, and the Prime Minister's office agreed that they would allow this UFO to land. Then AFA wanted an agreement that once he met with whoever they were going to meet with, and this is 1954, they would allow him to take off without trying to stop him or do anything. The RCMP agreed, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police agreed, and according to her, the government went into a cabinet meeting and they couldn't give a 100% guarantee that they could do this. And so Smith said, "Okay, that's fine, it's called off. We're not landing anything there if we can't get this absolute agreement." So the government actually tells a story, then they tell their version of the story. They opened this base, nothing landed, therefore UFOs don't exist. The fact of the matter was that there was actually an alien involved, that they were actually, answers the question of where the how the aliens knew where to go. And this is the article, this is out of the Ottawa Journal, talks about the UFO landing site. Now the final point, and then I'm finished, is to go to the final slide, which is the material that all the documents I'm referred to, the quotes, all that sort of stuff, is available on the top website, the Smith HTM site, and the Wilbur Smith tape, where the son is talking about the hardware and he talks about all sorts of bizarre stuff. It's a 45-minute interview. It's very good to check in on. It's at this virtually strange, it was Strange Days Indeed, which is a show that runs Sunday night. It's a radio show. You can pick it up on the internet. It's extremely good show. They have a lot of very good witnesses, a lot of good people on there. It runs for 3 hours. They're the ones that actually did the interview, and that's the site. You can look it up. It's tape number 179. And basically, that's it. I'm finished. Thanks.
Okay, that's the hardcore. They get up on Sunday morning. Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got some good stuff on Sunday morning, too. If you heard Grant's talk yesterday, he's back with more, and it's just as good, I'm sure. In 1954, our radar picked up two objects orbiting the Earth. You may have, if you read Donald Kehoe's Flying Saucer Conspiracy, you remember he discussed this. And it was claimed, well, you know, it was asteroids or meteors that just accidentally came into Earth orbit, 400 miles out, 600 miles out, I think. One at 4 and one at 6. And we didn't hear a lot more about them. Well, you're going to hear a lot more about them this morning. So welcome back, Grant Cameron.
Okay, thank you. This morning, as I'm doing my presentation, I would like you to play MJ-12. This morning, I want you to pretend that you're in the situation where you've been given the problem of dealing with this whole subject, because it sort of puts everything in perspective. You'll see it in a different light if you look at it from their side of the story. As Lou said, two objects were picked up. It was actually in the fall of 1953 by U.S. Air Force experimental long-range radar. Let's get on the screen here. And the radar was developed by the Air Force, and they had a number of incidents with the radar. And what I'm saying is you can pretend that you're the MJ-12 people, and you've just picked up these two objects rotating around the Earth, 400, 600 miles out. And the military mind, if it doesn't have an enemy, usually it tries to find an enemy. They have to be on alert. They have to try to determine when the enemy attacks. And there's a story told about one of the experimental long-range radars. They had the thing running, and suddenly they detected the Russian bombers coming. And they immediately alerted the Strategic Air Command to get the bombers up on their way to Russia. And a few minutes later, they said, whoops, made a mistake. They had picked up the moon coming up over the horizon. Thanks. And Bill Cosby tells a story about whoops. He tells about a guy being operated on, and they're giving him just a local anesthetic, and the doctor's operating away, and the doctor says, whoops. And the guy says, what do you mean, whoops? What's going on? And the guy says, ah, don't worry about it, sir, it's nothing. And he says, no, don't tell me that. You tell me what happened. I'm not stupid. I know what a whoops means. So the situation here is that the Pentagon goes into a state of panic. Three tracking stations are set up. One is set up in Arizona, one in New Mexico, and one outside of Berlin, Germany, to try to track these two objects. The story, an important part of the story, is that they're picked up in the fall of 1953, but the story doesn't break until August the 23rd, 54, in Aviation Week in Space Technology. The story is run the very next day by the New York Times as well. And in their story, they say that the Air Force has picked up two objects, and that Dr. Lincoln La Paz has stated the two objects are natural satellites. Lincoln La Paz has been tied in with UFOs a number of times. He was tied in with the late 1940 Green Fireball incidents. He was also tied in a number of times with UFO crash recoveries. And this is because La Paz was an expert at meteorites. He was able to determine when a meteorite came in, he could go and talk to witnesses at the angle a meteorite was coming, all this sort of stuff, and he could determine where the object had come down. So what you got to remember when you're looking at this story is that from the fall of 1953 till August the 23rd and 24th, this story is completely secret. The public does not know these two objects are going around. Now, a number of the things that happen, and some of this is going to be speculation on my part, you take a look and you look at some of the incidents that have been written up in UFO books, and you look at them again in terms of looking at them from the perspective that the military secretly is watching these two objects. One of the incidents is a woman, a columnist by the name of Dorothy Kilgallen, who writes a story in February of 1954. And this is something I really didn't have much time to check on. But as far as I know, Dorothy Kilgallen didn't really write UFO stories. She's famous for writing up a story that the British, based on high-ranking sources that she had talked to, the British had recovered a flying saucer. That was one of the stories. This is the other story that I know that she wrote about UFOs. And as I said, see this in perspective of the flying saucer, or these objects going around the Earth. Kilgallen wrote, "Flying saucers are regarded as of such vital importance that there will be a special hush-hush meeting of world military leaders this summer." Now, the question that arose to me after I'd read this before, and when I looked at it in perspective of this, I said, well, why would you put the capitalist and the fascist and the communist world military leaders all in one room? Are they going to discuss flying saucer sightings? Is that why you would call all these people together to share the secrets of UFOs? In another time, in another place, in a White House, there was something called My Fantasy. And it goes like this. "I've often wondered, One of us, all of us in the world, discovered that we were threatened by a power from outer space, from another world. Wouldn't we all of a sudden find that we don't have any differences between us at all? We were all human beings, citizens of the world, and wouldn't we come together to fight that particular threat? So if you look at the Kilgallen thing in terms of the two objects and what Ronald Reagan called my fantasy, it would be a speculation on my part, but I think fair speculation, that perhaps the military was looking at these two objects as the alien invasion. Because one of the things that Kehoe doesn't really spell out is the fact that these were huge objects. Or he says they're huge objects, he doesn't really give the size of them. Later on, a size, I believe, 190 miles across is given, but that's given by somebody else. So if you're the military and you're sitting there looking at this thing, you're looking at you're looking to try to speculate, well, is this an alien and his wife and two kids on a summer vacation? Or is this an invasion of the Eighth Army? Somebody's bringing everybody. Let's go to the next screen here. The objects, according to Kehoe, his Air Force sources were stating that the objects were leaving orbit. They were not able to track these objects constantly. They would track them, they would lose them, they would track them, they were losing them, which would clearly indicate the objects were not natural satellites, as Lincoln LaPaz was written up in the New York Times as speculating. The Aviation Week, when they wrote up the story, they referred to it as the Pentagon scare. The New York Times stated that the Air Force was thrown into a flap through the whole summer of 1954 over these two objects. Another item that I think is important, and sometimes in ufology we forget that you have to look at things in light of when they happened and not impose our views today. In 1954, the Mars factor was very big. 1952, there was a large flap of UFO sightings around the United States, and it occurred at the closest approach of Mars to the Earth. Even Wilbur Smith talks about this, the 27-month period, that every 27 months when Mars came close, the number of UFO sightings increased. The closest approach was July the 2nd, 54. And when I'm talking, a number of these dates are very important. All these dates, I'll tie them all together at the end. Dr. Fred Singer was advising Eisenhower that he was an advisor on outer space space matters to Eisenhower, and NICAP wrote him up as advising Eisenhower that Phobos, one of the planets or the moons around Mars, was possibly inhabited and hollow. Now, when I put this thing up on the internet a couple months ago, James Oberg immediately jumped on this like Clinton on an intern. And he basically, every time I post anything, he jumps on it, and he came across and said, well, Fred Singer's denying this. And basically the denial, the way I read it, from the part he quoted, and I don't know what he left out of what Singer said, was that he had done calculations and determined that Phobos was not hollow, and that therefore, according to Oberg, I was totally wrong. And I happened to be on the road at the time. I was at the University of Wyoming, and I had to go race into the library and start pulling the books, and I pulled Oberg's book on Mars. And I found, actually, in Oberg's book, this whole reference to Singer doing these mathematical calculations. Found out they're done in the mid-70s. So I posted back to Oberg, and I said, well, I can see that, but you got to realize that something that he may have calculated in the 1970s is totally irrelevant to what he may have told the president in the 1950s. At that point, Oberg gave up, and some people said it's the first time I've ever seen him give up on an argument. He said, okay, have it your way, enjoy. So there were people in this time period who were very concerned about Mars being inhabited. In April 1954, now this, I picked this up, and now I'm going to have to check this based on the last item that I have listed here. Reader's Digest, fairly conservative magazine, runs a piece in April 1954 talking about Mars, the Martians coming to Earth and why they would be coming here. And I guess a lot of this is based upon the fact that Mars is approaching and there's a lot of articles and stuff being written. But it's a dead serious piece. And what they sort of look at and they say, well, perhaps they're coming to Earth because their atmosphere is bad and they have to get they're out of closing in on losing all their oxygen. That's the one piece. The next piece is the more important piece. This is a piece that was written by a high-ranking Air Force intelligence colonel. Kehoe talks about this article, and if you read his book, he was absolutely shocked that this article was being circulated around. And Odell was this high-ranking officer, but the article was also approved by Air Force Security, which is another key point to remember. And the article was entitled Planet Earth, Host to Extraterrestrial Life. The first line of the article starts as follows. Granted that superintelligences in another solar system are looking for a suitable planet for a second home, why would the Earth be singled out? And again, I say, look at this in perspective of the people who are watching these two objects secretly rotate around the Earth. The article goes on to say, to speculate, that aliens are now observing our planet, and that the possible reason is that they have a dying planet and they're looking for another place to be. Now, they took the article, the Pentagon took the article, and they circulated it among the White House press corps, and they were trying to get somebody to run this article. The problem was there was two conditions to running the article. First of all, you were not allowed to say that a high-ranking Air Force intelligence colonel had written the article. The second thing they weren't allowed to do was they weren't allowed to say that Air Force Security had cleared this article. They were just simply supposed to run the article. And of course, nobody in the Washington press corps would pick up this, would take the bait. Nobody would publish the article. Kehoe read the article, and he was very shocked and tried to figure out why the Air Force was trying to circulate this theory about the aliens surveying our planet and a possible takeover. Now, in the spring of 1954, there was a big appropriation of money. $24 million of that money went to the Air Force for what they called secret projects. Two of the people that wrote about this were Major Kehoe, wrote about these satellites. The other guy who was writing about these satellites was Frank Edwards, who was the Art Bell of his day. He had 10 million listeners, had written a number of books on UFOs. And Edwards stated that his sources told him that most of, or all of this $24 million appropriation given to the Air Force was to track these two satellites and to try to figure out what was going on. As I said, dates are very important. May the 5th, May the 6th, and May the 13th, you have these two big objects rotating around the Earth. On May the 5th, 6th, 13th, this is kept secret as well. The Air Force is able to keep this secret. One large object is seen to come down over top of the Pentagon, over Washington. It's up at 90,000 feet. They scramble the jets. They bring the jets in. And the jets just circle around. There's nothing they can do. The object is way above them. The Nike missiles that they have can't reach these objects. And Kehoe says they keep this completely secret. June the 12th, which is also going to, as you'll see later, is a very important date. And June the 14th, the big object returns to Washington. This time it's at 79,000 feet. And again, they're unable to do anything about it. This object is just there. And Kehoe relates this to the fact that he figures these are the two objects, and they're coming down. And this is his Air Force sources are telling him that these things are leaving orbit. Now, to tie in with this, and this is another statement that's been quoted, General Nathan Twining on May the 15th, 2 days after the third big object, sends the East Coast on alert over Washington, D.C., Nathan Twining departs from a speech at the Air Force Base in Amarillo, Texas. And what he says is this. The first part has always been quoted by a number of people. He says, the best brains in the country are working on this problem. And again, I say, who's Twining talking to here? The best brains in the country are working on the problem of unidentified flying objects, trying to solve this riddle. And then he goes on to say 10% of the flying saucer reports are unidentified, and I go along with this. It's the most important part that I see in terms of you looking at this from the perspective of perhaps he's talking to you in the Pentagon watching these two objects. The final part that is very rarely quoted, Twining says this, departing from this speech. If they are from Mars, and if there is a people in a world that far ahead of us, I don't think we have anything to worry about. And that's only 2 days after these large objects are seen. One of the other items that I have listed here is July 16, 1954, is the famous Twining-Cutler memo. So again, you have Twining being tied in. And the July 16th event is not a meeting. It's a special studies project briefing. They're briefing the MJ-12 people on something. Now, this memo, of course, has come under great controversy. And I only bring it up because Cutler and Twining are the people who are involved in this. And later on, I've already mentioned Twining, later on you're going to hear about Robert Cutler, who was a national security advisor to President Eisenhower. Some of the other events that would show the government was interested in these two objects. In June of 1954, Deputy Commander of Intelligence at where Blue Book was in Dayton, John O'Mara, confirms to Leonard Stringfield that the Air Force is tracking these two objects and that they're seriously watching these two objects. The National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics in the fall of 1954 picks up a signal, they say, from a strange satellite. That is confirmed by an astronomer in France who also picks up this signal. In 1954, and this story I've got on my, I'm only going to tell you part of this story. It's a very, very bizarre story. It's told in the CIA 1997 whitewash report, and I'm surprised it even told the story. It's a story that's told about the Mayer sisters in Chicago. And it's on my internet site, and it's called AFA Sends a Message, if you want to read it there. And what happened, in short, I'll tell you the first part of the story. There was a fellow by the name of Mills, who was a freelance radio announcer in Chicago on WGN, had John Otto, who was a UFO researcher in Chicago, and who was also turned out to be a contactee, on his show. And the story is already broken in August of 1954 in Aviation Week about these two satellites. And so they decide that they're going to run a little experiment. They're going to try to talk to these two satellites rotating around the Earth. So at 11:15 during the show, they state, at 11:25, we're going to send a message to these two satellites. And what we want the satellites to do is to send a message to the audience. So what they propose to do is that everybody's supposed to get their tape recorder, all the radio audience, and they're going to turn off the studio mics at 11:25. They're going to send the message out, come in, spacemen. They're going to turn off the studio mics, and they're going to give 15 seconds, and what the aliens are supposed to do is tap into the WGN transmitter and transmit a signal to the audience. So 11:25, they give the signal, come in, spacemen. They shut off the studio mics. And they have a radio inside the studio. They hear nothing. It's completely silent. So both guys, at 11:30, the show is over. They leave the studio, figure nothing's happened. And the phone starts to ring. There's four people from various areas, Wisconsin, Chicago, that have claimed to have picked up a signal. Now, when I went after the CIA documents for this, one of the CIA documents states that they found out that there was a bunch of ham radio operators who also claimed to have picked up a signal. One of the people who picked up a signal was in Chicago. It was two sisters. They were very old ladies that were very interested in UFOs and this sort of thing. They phoned in the studio and they said, we don't think this is very funny. Why would you play Jingle Bells? We don't think this is very funny. And they said, well, sorry, we didn't play Jingle Bells. And nothing happened. We, as far as we know, nobody picked anything up. They said, oh, yes, we taped this. We picked this thing up and it sounds like Jingle Bells and has this funny noise in the background. So basically, they've got this, and it's written up in I can't remember the name of the magazine, but it's an aviation technical magazine. Writes the story of the Mayer sisters and their UFO experiences, and also writes up this story about them sending this signal, or receiving this signal from this test that was done at this radio station. So the CIA sees this, and they decide They got to get this tape. But of course, the CIA is not involved in UFOs. The only time publicly they've stated they've been involved in the UFOs is the Robertson panel. So they're trying to figure out what they're going to do, how they're going to get this tape. So this is already the spring of 1954. It's somewhere February of 1955, pardon me, after this article is run. So they decide what they'll do is it's February, it's close enough to Halloween. So what they decide they're going to do is they dress up two guys in Air Force officers, and they fly these Air Force guys to Chicago to try to get the tape. The first time they're there, the Mary sisters say, no, you can't have the tape. We're not going to give it to you. We're very happy that the government's interested. They couldn't get it. The second time, they get the tape. They go back to figure the story's over. Now, the rest of the story you're going to have to read on the website, and basically it is in 1957, Leon Davidson, who was with NICAP, suddenly decides that he's very interested in this. What did whoever the Air Force analyzed this thing, and what did they find out, and the whole story. He had talked to the Mayer sisters. And basically what it comes down to is the CIA gets caught. The CIA is trying to figure out how they're going to cover for the fact that they dressed up two guys as Air Force officers to get this tape. So that's another story that shows the interest, that the CIA was desperate to get this tape. And when you read the article, you see all the desperate things they did to try to cover up the fact that they had tried to get this tape. Another item that I mention here is Stuart Aslop, who is a syndicated columnist. And this is a very interesting point. There was three observatories, and more observatories were set up to try to track this object. One of the places, for example, was White Sands Missile Range. They used the long-range telescopes at White Sands to try to pick up these two objects. Wilson announces in early 1955 that the Wilson Observatory has been added to the search, and he states that they are confirming that these objects are artificial. They are not, as La Paz said, artificial satellites. A couple weeks later, Aslop, and he says that he's got this from high-ranking government sources and sources inside the National Security Council. A couple weeks later, he writes another article which basically states that Robert Cutler, who was the National Security Advisor to the President, was so angry at his article, so angry at the leaks about the satellites, that the people who worked with him in his office were afraid to be seen with him. And I had a quote from Cutler, and I lost it, and I went back to, I emailed the Eisenhower Library, and they couldn't find it. But Cutler was fanatical about security. But Aslop had written this article, and apparently, according to Aslop, they were just furious that this story had finally leaked, because they had kept it secret, and they had sort of maintained the fact that these things were artificial. Now, the final item is the government looks to Mrs. Frances Swan. Now, as I told you before, she was the star quarterback of the AFA team. Mrs. Frances Swan was observed by the following agencies. And what's more important than the agencies is the people inside the agencies that were looking at her. The Frances Swan case was handled by J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, the head of Navy Intelligence, SB. As I mentioned yesterday, this Art Lundahl, who was a high-ranking CIA officer. The story I'm going to tell you in a minute is about the White House. President Eisenhower handled this case. Air Force, it was handled by Blue Book, and Robert Friend had handled this thing. FBI sent their documents to Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and the Secret Service handled this, but we don't know who handled it in the Secret Service. And the Canadian government handled that was Wilbur Smith, who was looking at Mrs. Frances Swan. She was very, very, people were very interested in this woman for whatever reason. Now, Frances Swan's stories mysteriously starts at exactly the same time as they pick up these objects. It starts in the fall of 1953. Her version of the story is she's hanging up decorations at a Halloween party. At the town hall in Elliott, Maine, where she lived. And I sort of assume maybe this was the same Halloween party that the CIA guys went to, you know, dress up like Air Force officers and take the wives out. She's hanging up these decorations, and a fellow walks in, and she said he was a striking fellow. She'd never seen him before. It's a small, very small town. Everybody knows everybody. This guy is unknown. He walks into the room, and he walks across, and she's hanging up these decorations, and he just walks up to her. He doesn't say anything to her. She talks to him. He walks. He leaves. He comes back in. He walks up to her a second time. He leaves. And she said, I can still remember him to this day. I can remember him if I just look back walking away. It turns out, according to her, this was Atha. And in April of 1954, she starts getting messages. And in part of these messages, Atha says, that was me at the Halloween dance. And I was supposed to shake your hand, but there was a bunch of people there, and I was afraid to do it. She's getting a sharp tone in her left ear. This is how it starts. She is into going to seances and this sort of stuff, but she really isn't into channeling or anything like this. Near the end of April, she starts getting this tone, and it's been described a number of ways, like the musical note A, a high-pitched sort of noise that disturbs her, it hurts. She's getting messages day and night from Atha and from a second alien by the name of Ponar. And these two aliens are commanding two ships. Atha is commanding a ship called M4, and Ponar is commander of a ship called L11. And as to where they are, Mrs. Swan says, well, these two ships are rotating around the Earth, these huge ships. And I think she describes, don't quote me, but I think she said they were 190 miles across. So, of course, she doesn't know what to do. And she said this is driving her crazy. She can't sleep. These messages are coming in. And she's getting them through automatic writing. So she goes down, and she goes to Vice Admiral Knowles, who lived about a mile away in Elliott, Maine. He comes down, and he checks it out, and he asks her a bunch of technical questions about different things, and he's just absolutely amazed at this woman, her ability to come to answer these questions based upon her education. So he starts contacting people. He contacts Navy Intelligence. He contacts his friend Wilbur Smith, and Wilbur Smith comes down, and she becomes Wilbur Smith's main contact to Atha. He also contacts President Eisenhower. And that's the story that I tracked 2 years ago and that I'm going to tell you about. Let me get on the right sheet here. I was at the Eisenhower Library, and there's a set of FBI documents that I show on my website that describe the story of Mrs. Smith. It also describes Knowles. It blocks out the name, but I can figure out who it is. So I go to the Eisenhower Library, and I go to the archivist, and I say to him, okay, I've got this FBI document, and I'm looking for this letter that was written to the president. It was written by Admiral Knowles around 1954, and I show him the document, and he says, okay, fine, and he leaves, and he comes back about an hour later, and he says, well, he says, I think I found only one letter from Admiral Knowles, and he says, the only problem is we don't have the letter anymore. And I said, well, what happened to the letter? He said, well, it was transferred to the Secret Service. And I said, well, that's fine. Just tell me the details, and I'll go to the Secret Service, because I want to get this letter, because it was Knowles talking about Swan, and apparently it had some of the actual messages stapled to it. He told me the letter was written May the 9th, 1954. And if you remember, this was when they had these three big objects descend over Washington. Transferred out to Secret Service on June the 10th, 1954, which is critical because I had a big fight, and I have on my website an article called Incident at Eisenhower, and it's the whole story of how I got this document and how they tried to stop me from getting this what was called a transfer sheet that notified the fact that this document had been transferred out of the White House. And it's very important because they were telling me, well, the reason this thing had been sent to the Secret Service is, well, usually somebody's crazy or they're a threat to the president. And I argued at one point with the assistant director of the Eisenhower Library, and I said, well, if it was a threat to the president, they would have transferred the letter in the first hour. And this, if you're talking about kook letters, I said, this guy's a vice admiral writing to the president. And I said, why would they hold the letter for a month? I said, is this normal procedure for the White House to hold a letter for a month? He said, okay, I see your point. It is not normal procedure for the White House. They get tens of thousands of letters a day. They handle them very quickly. And unless something has gone wrong, they transfer them to wherever they're transferring them right away. So the dates are very important, May the 9th and June the 10th. One of the other things I did at the Eisenhower Library, I was searching everything. I was searching all the contactees. I was trying to find out whether any of the contactees had been
in contact with the president. And the way you do that is you run what's called an alpha search. And what you can do is put anybody's name in, and you can say, okay, I've got this person's name. Did he ever have any contact with the president? And they can tell you whether the person ever phoned the president, whether he ever wrote a letter to the president, whether he was ever in a meeting with the president. One of the people I wrote did an alpha search on was Captain Howard Orville. Orville was described, when you see Kehoe's version of the 54 satellites, he talks about Captain Orville. He was the president's weather control commission. He was ran the weather control commission for the president. When I did searches on him, specifically at the Eisenhower Library, I couldn't find anything on the guy. There was nothing. There was, on his agency, there was a couple of small budget-type references in different documents, but there really was nothing on him. Now, he's interviewed in 1954, and I'm going to read this. He's interviewed twice, and Kehoe writes this up, and I managed to find the actual interview. I'm going to read the interview to you. It was very strange because we couldn't figure out what Orville's connection was to the satellites, and now I've sort of got a connection. I mentioned yesterday the story about the U.S. Navy running Project Magnet. One of the things that's been discovered is one of the things they were doing is, as well as mapping the Earth's geomagnetic field, is they were running weather control modification experiments, and that was Orville's business. He was in weather modification, and the other job that he had, as I understand, was to do weather reports for Air Force One. Now here's the interview, and it's done by a fellow by the name of Corbin, who was with NICAP. It's done on a radio station in New York, and the interview goes like this. Corbin asks, do you know of any condition under which two such objects could enter the Earth's atmosphere and pick up orbits at 400 and 600 miles? Captain Orville says, no, not that I know of. Your doubts are well justified. So Corbin asks him, if there are two bodies circling, they would be unnatural or not natural. And Captain Orville says, if that should be true, military secrecy would prevent discussion. Corbin asks him, then is it not possible that the two bodies, if they are there, might well be space stations? Orville answers, well, that is an interesting thought. I don't know of any set of circumstances that would account for the two bodies that are now orbiting the Earth. And then Corbin says, but we still have a puzzle of something circling the Earth. And Orville says, yes, we do. In 1957, he's interviewed again by Corbin on the same radio station. And he, according to the NICAP article that released this, Orville says it maintains the same ideas that he had on the unknown satellites that he had expressed in 1954. And during the broadcast on October 24th, 1957, this is now reading from the NICAP article, when asked if there was any new information about the unknown satellites, Captain Orville said that it appeared that the military might have kept the matter from publication. From the American people, asked Corbin. In reply, Orville said that he did not wish to call it a deliberate cover-up, but he added, but we didn't hear anything more about it, did we? Now, trying to tie in Orville, when I gave them the alpha search to do, they come back, and the archivist brings me a sheet of paper, and I've actually done the piece of paper. He gives me Captain Orville, and he writes down, he says, well, he never talked to the president on phone. He never wrote the president. We have nothing there. We only have one incident, but he was in the Oval Office. And of course, here's a guy who you couldn't find in any White House records, and of course the obvious question is, what is he doing in the Oval Office? Later that day, it took me a while to catch on to this, later that day, I think I was camping there, I was at the campsite, and suddenly I realized the light came on. It's exactly the same date that the Eisenhower people transferred the Swan letter out of the White House after holding it for a month. So, of course, I run back to the Eisenhower Library, and I start checking these names. Now, the names that are on there, one of them is Lewis Douglas, and he's the assistant to Orville. And if you can't find anything on Orville, you're not going to find anything on him. So he really doesn't count. He's just an assistant to Orville. And they're in the Oval Office with Eisenhower. And the other two people that are in the office are Donald Quarles and Alan Waterman. So I pull the material from the president's schedule, and I start looking at who these people are.
Alan Waterman was from National Science Foundation, and guess what his expertise was? Satellites. Donald Quarles was head of research and development for the U.S. Air Force in the fall of 1953, and he was in charge of the long-range experimental radar. He also was an expert on satellites. 2 weeks before this June the 10th meeting in the Oval Office, Quarles was in the National Security Council briefing the President and the National Security Council on satellites. Now, it's not the satellites, well, we haven't got the actual records, but they're talking about satellites, about trying to put a satellite into orbit themselves. So these people are experts on the satellite thing. At 2 o'clock the afternoon, before the final slides I'm going to show are to tie all these people together and to prove to you that these people are experts, the people that were in that Oval Office either had talked greatly about satellites like Orville had, and somehow Kehoe knew the connection, but in the Kehoe files I asked, and the people who have the files said they really couldn't find anything that ties him in to the satellites, why he would know about the satellites. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, on exactly the same day, it seems these things all happen together, the U.S. Navy intelligence has got a meeting. They've flown back to Elliott, Maine again. They keep flying back and forth, and they've got a meeting with AFA at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. AFA is supposed to come across, Mrs. Smith is supposed to channel him at that time, and they're supposed to ask him all new questions or whatever they were doing with him. It turns out that AFA is always late. At 6 o'clock, she gets a message from PONAR, and she says, AFA is busy. And AFA was always busy, and it's a strange little story I'll add. AFA was always busy. They were claiming that they were working on the atomic damage we were doing with our atomic explosions. And AFA spent a lot of his time in the Pacific, according to the documents, fixing fault lines that had become unstable due to the fact that we were detonating these atomic bombs. Now, the strange thing about that is the fact that in 1953, the idea of plate tectonics, that there was fault lines in the Pacific, was not really known. I mean, it was not discussed. The other strange incident about this is that one of the people who was developed plate tectonics is a guy by the name of Dr. Wilson, who Kehoe identifies as one of the people who worked with Wilbur Smith on Project Magnet. Now, the final one, I need my pointer here. This is your typical, I don't know if you can even read it here, typical top secret document. It's a memorandum for the President. The subject is Earth satellites. And they're basically discussing the Russians have done us in, tricked us on something or another. Can you move that slide down just a bit? No. They're discussing a meeting. And the meeting, the two top names on the meeting for 8:30 wherever the meeting was being held, the two top people on that listed on that thing are Quarles and Waterman. Again, a tie-in that these two people are very connected. Now, we're out of slides here. The two last slides are missing, but I'll tell you what the two last slides are. When I was at the Eisenhower Library, I started pulling withdrawal sheets for the National Security Council from their satellite file. This is a file that has all the stuff on trying to launch the Earth satellite for the Americans. And what they have is a whole list of different documents. When they declassify stuff, there's stuff that they don't want, so they do a withdrawal and they put a sheet in the file to say this document's been withdrawn. The documents, when I finally got there, they had all been declassified, but the list of the documents that they had originally pulled were all still there. And most of the documents that had been withdrawn were top secret documents from 54, 55. And all these guys are listed. There's, for example, memo, Cutler, Robert Cutler, Alan Waterman, subject, satellites. Waterman to the President, subject, satellites. Quarles to Waterman, satellites. Quarles to Cutler, satellites. And basically goes to show that this Mrs. Swan was taken very seriously, that the idea of the satellites actually made it to the Oval Office, and I firmly believe that the reason these people were brought into the Oval Office on June 10th was to discuss this letter that had come from Admiral Knowles,
and that they were seriously trying to figure out, even at the White House level, what they were going to do about these two objects. That's all I have. That's basically the rest of the story, and I'm sure there's going to be more details coming out, because there, it didn't take much to get these additional details over and above what Kehoe and Edwards had written about it in 1954. So I'm sure there's an awful lot more material that will come out about these two satellites. Thanks.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.